Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral docket. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Timberwalk Apartments, etc. versus Kenny Renee Kane from Harris County. Douglas Wayne Perry and others versus Sean and Sandra Nash individually and his next friend of a minor from Travis County. And Nancy N. Scherer, successor guardian of the state of Richard Milton versus the Court of Appeals for the 3rd Judicial District on original mandamus proceeding. In each of these matters, the court has permitted 20 minutes for each side to present argument. If both sides are present, the petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising our marshal. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument, and we'll complete each argument, of course, before lunch. The arguments are being recorded by our clerk, and you may purchase a tape of the argument. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioners in Timberwalk Apartments versus Kane.
May I please report, Mr. Jasper Kinley will present argument for the petition.
Thank you. Members of the court, I speak to the petitioners today regarding what we perceive to be the need for clarification to assist trial judges and courts of appeals in resolving an issue that comes before them constantly and about which they continue to issue decisions that I believe are at variance with the guidance that has been given so far today by this court. There seems to be a constant tension between the distinction issued in proximate cause cases regarding foreseeability and the foreseeability issue in duty cases. Courts, particularly including at the appellate level, and it seems particularly in Houston, are conflating or equating the foreseeability that is required for proximate cause with the foreseeability that is required to establish a duty. I believe that courts, particularly in this case, but by no means limited to this case, have subsequent decisions in Holder versus Mellon Mortgage in Houston and in Silva in Corpus Christi indicate courts consistently appear to fail to recognize that the very thing that must be foreseen to create a duty is not merely crime, but an unreasonable risk of harm from crime. The language of the court in this case is very similar to the language of the court in Holder because they were written by the same judge, Justice Fowler. Justice Fowler, although an excellent justice, is in the same situation as so many other judges are, seeming to rely on Nixon in the absence of clarification from this court that Nixon isn't the relevant security case. Nixon, however, being this court's most clearly discussed security case, this court's greatest exposition on the law of security, is favored by the courts of appeals, even though it is inapplicable. This court's holding in Walker is actually much more apropos, although it's quite limited. In Kane and in Holder, Justice Fowler discussed the duty to provide security in terms of the prevention of what seems to be the mere possibility of crime. Her language in Kane was with regard to the duty of a premises occupier to provide adequate security measures to protect invitees or people on the property. Her language in Holder was concerned with, was very similar and was addressing the duty of the owner of a parking garage to provide security not even for the people who were intended to use the parking garage, but for people who might be, as the court called it, gratuitous licensees. In that case, a woman who was brought against her will by an on-duty Houston police officer to that garage and sexually assaulted in his police car at a time when the garage was not open for anyone intended to use it because all of the employees of Mellon Mortgage had long since gone home. It was during the middle of the night. The basis for the imposition of that duty, of the duty in that case, was seemingly even less significant than the duty that was imposed in this case. that being that there were no locks on the parking garage, and in the absence of a chain and a lock across the entrance to the parking garage, it was foreseeable that someone might drive into the parking garage, might commit a crime, and the mere fact that she's the police officer had that parking garage as the best available site for his depredations was chosen by the court as sufficient reason to impose a duty on the owner of the parking garage to guard against crime in a situation when it never had any reason to believe that anyone it had a duty to protect, anyone it invited onto its property, would ever be in that garage.
Should, you know, a commercial landlord, and I talk about commercial providing residential living areas for sale, why shouldn't that landlord have a duty to provide reasonable security?
I believe the landlord does have a duty to provide reasonable security beginning at the point at which there's a condition that's unreasonably dangerous.
Well, let's start with that. A homeowner could choose, an individual homeowner could choose any level of security they wish. They could choose to accept the risk with no security. They could choose to accept some risk with some security. They could choose to have no risk and a tremendous amount of security. A tenant in an apartment complex can't make those choices. They could lock their door. They perhaps could do their own intrusion alarm, but they couldn't prevent people from coming on to the common areas. They couldn't prevent their neighbor from, who's a rapist, to move in next door to them. There's a number of things that a tenant in a housing complex could not do that an individual homeowner could do to protect themselves. Why isn't it appropriate to move that duty of the choice of security to the landlord? Not the foreseeability of crime, but just the reasonable, the issue being the reasonableness of the security precautions taken in, as it relates to the crime in the area.
Your Honor, I believe your hypothetical relates to the availability and opportunity to protect against crime. And my answer would be that the landlord isn't under an obligation to do that, just as the homeowner isn't under an obligation to do it. Yes, the option exists, but I would say that most residences don't have controlled access gates. I dare say the number of...
But they could. But, I mean, the homeowner could choose to do that, but a tenant couldn't choose to.
Well, the tenant's choice exists, and it's exercised, admittedly subject to serious financial constraints for many people, by the ability of the tenant to choose to live in a complex that offers that. And complexes do offer that based on the market demand. And the market demand, however, is set in relation to price. It's possible to live in an extraordinarily well-protected multi-family dwelling, a high-rise or a place with gates and security, but you have to pay for it. And that's no different from the requirement that if you or I wish to have a gate and a security system, we must also pay for it. And so I see the issue as cost versus benefit, and the reality that so many judges on the courts of appeals and trial judges and juries don't want to face is that crime is everywhere, and not everyone can afford the same way to protect themselves against crime. And sympathy often leads juries, although in Houston our problem is not so much juries as judges, to declare this duty, I think, out of sympathy, without a hard-headed recognition that everyone has to pay money and devote resources to protect themselves against crime. And multifamily dwellers who are tenants have that same opportunity. And the answer may be, as in the case of this unfortunate lady, she and her roommate could afford $500 a month. That was their limit. And it may very well be true that you can't pay $500 a month and get what your Honor has described. And that probably is the case, and that relates to the allocation of resources in society. And I don't think that's really properly a subject for anything but legislation. Because if the legislature, for example, were to address that problem, they would be singling out security as a special area for socialization. And they would be saying that everyone in society shall pay for this minimum standard of security.
The statute's required that they have locks and exterior doors.
Yes.
And isn't there some evidence in the record that the apartment complex knew that sliding glass doors could be opened even if locked by being pushed up and back?
That was highly disputed.
But there was fact, there was evidence, even though it's disputed, there is evidence to that testimony.
There is evidence in the record from the security guard for the plaintiff, or pardon me, the security expert for the plaintiff, that it is possible to rock sliding glass doors as a general proposition. There's no evidence that this particular sliding glass door was open that way. That was the plaintiff's argument, but the security experts went out and they couldn't do it.
But they testified.
How about the fingerprints that were very low?
The fingerprints were actually about palm level, and they were the rightest fingerprints, no question. But that would indicate an attempt. It might indicate that he was just trying to slide it open to see if it was locked. Of course, it would also be consistent with trying to rock it open. But the bottom line is that the experts couldn't open it. And no one really knows. The truth is no one really knows how he got in, and that was indeed a fact issue. But fortunately, we stand here with a jury verdict in our favor, and so that fact issue has been resolved our way. And the only issue we bring to this court is a charge issue. And the charge, we insist, was appropriate on this court's own precedent, on the basis of Tidwell, Walker versus Harris. This court has clearly indicated that we're dealing with a premises condition.
How do we know when there's unreasonable risk?
At present, Your Honor, we don't. And my suggestion is that this court address that. I've talked about the restatement, Section 344. I perceive the problem to be that courts are referring to Section 448, as discussed in Nixon, regarding the fairly minimal level of foreseeability that must exist when this court has defined, or statute has defined the duty and the breach as in Nixon. I'm not suggesting that this court adopt comment F, but I do believe it would be a major step forward in terms of clarification for everyone as to where they stand if this court were to take something like comment F as a starting point and tell the jury. I know that this court and others abhor what are thought of as comments on the evidence, but when this court writes something and says this is what the jury should be said, trial judges won't regard that as a comment. They'll say, oh, thank heaven the Supreme Court has told me I can do this. And if this court were to write a modified version of comment F, the court would be giving jurors tremendous assistance, and trial judges at the summary judgment level, tremendous assistance in saying, you're not an insurer. Now, to me, comment F doesn't go far enough because it's hard to reconcile comment F with the concept that duty is a question of law for the court. And I believe that the court can harmonize the rule that duty is a question of law for the court with the general concept that the jury gets to resolve disputed fact issues bearing on the existence of duty by emphasizing that foreseeability of crime requires an above-average level of crime, requires crime of the type that suggests that there's a danger. In other words, not break-ins of cars, perhaps not even property crime at all, but if we're talking about a violent assault like a rape, there needs to be some evidence of crime on or next to the premises, as the court discussed in Walker, that suggests the possibility of a rape.
Here, there was evidence of 11 sexual assaults within a one-mile radius at the apartment where the attack occurred.
There are actually, if I might clarify, Your Honor,
according to the Court of Appeals opinion.
And the court is wrong in that because the court overstated the record. The record was of rape calls. And the difference between a rape call and an actual rape is the difference between whatever a police dispatcher takes down and what the investigation shows. When the investigation was done by the defense experts, it turned out that...
Is this in the record?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And in my brief. When investigation was done by the defense experts, it turned out that those 11 rape calls were in a broad area, but when you shrank it to the apartment community of some 8 or 11 apartments, of which Timberwalk was a part, it was reduced to one rape call in the entire preceding year, and that turned out not to be a rape at all. It turned out to be sexual touching, unwanted sexual touching by one adult of another.
But we have a situation here where the rape was committed by one of the tenants. Does it matter how many rape calls or actual rapes occurred outside of the apartment complex?
I think it does not, because the tenant was there and was in a position to commit any kind of crime that he wanted, subject only to his fear that he would be caught breaking and entering into someone's apartment. The access gates, for example, which I don't agree there's any duty to provide, certainly wouldn't stop somebody who lives there. nor would any kind of security officer who's at the gate saying, come in, don't come in. He wouldn't have stopped a resident. So pretty much residents are free to roam at will, and the only thing that will prevent them from breaking in is their fear that they'll be observed and caught if they're of a criminal line and they're going to break in if they can.
You're saying
that an apartment owner has no duty to provide any security whatsoever as long as at trial someone who sues you cannot establish that you're in an above average.
I believe that needs to be the law, Your Honor, because the alternative is that the statement in comment after the restatement, which has been followed widely by courts across the country, including some since I wrote my brief, the comment that you're not an insurer as a property owner becomes a dead letter.
Do you think that should be true even where the statutes require certain types of
The statute.
Or a municipal ordinance or any positive legal enactment.
Yes.
But anything beyond that.
Yes. As a matter of the common law, I'm suggesting to the court that, and I know the court has to develop the common law, and I know the court makes a choice. When you rule in a case like this, either way, you're making a choice, and I'm not suggesting the court abandon its role in developing the common law, but when the court develops it in a very positive manner in terms of imposing duties that haven't previously existed, I am suggesting that the people through the legislature are the ideal determiners of how broad that duty should be and especially what burden it should be.
What's the duty in an above average crime area? Suppose that you don't meet that criteria, that you have a higher than average.
That is the hardest question for me to answer, Your Honor, because I feel that courts across the nation give short shrift to the issue of burden. And I simply don't agree that a duty arises because crime is above average and even significant.
I thought that was the duty you were just asking us to adopt.
I'm suggesting that that's the threshold before there's even an issue of duty. I personally believe that the result of that kind of duty being imposed will be to drive stores out of areas where people are relatively poor, and they need the grocery store, they need the washateria, they need all the stores that we all take for granted across town, but which in any higher crime area are going to be higher crime locations. And the result of imposing a duty simply based on the incidence of crime upon people who provide those mom-and-pop type operations or small operations will be to drive their insurance to the point where they can't afford it.
Let me ask you quickly about the instruction that was given in this case. And again, going back to the sliding glass door, assuming for the moment that there was a statutory duty or an ordinance that required the apartment complex to secure exterior doors, why was this instruction not error when the jury was told the tenant had to complain about it? In this instance, there at least seems to me some evidence that the apartment complex needed the door didn't properly function, and the tenant didn't know that. Wouldn't this instruction improperly skew that factual determination by the jury?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the latch was provided. It isn't a situation where the apartment complex didn't provide a door lock.
But they knew that in some instances the latches would not prevent entry, that the latch could be circumvented by pushing the door open.
Well,
in the record that they knew that?
There's an issue that, yes, it is in the record that they're generally aware that people have open sliding glass doors
in that manner.
Yes. But that does not mean that that's because that's inherent in the design of a sliding glass door. The statute requires that there be a lock on a sliding glass door, and there was a lock. In any given apartment unit, the landlord has to be put on notice that there's a problem before it has any kind of statutory duty.
But that's not the point. Here they knew the lock was not functioning to actually secure the door. In some apartments,
yes, Your Honor, but I'm suggesting it's got to be resolved on a unit-by-unit basis. The mere general knowledge that these locks can go bad is no different from any door lock.
But that was something that the apartment complex might have had knowledge about that you wouldn't expect a tenant necessarily to know.
I see your point. On the contrary, Your Honor, I'm suggesting that the heart of the case with respect to the door lock is that only Tammy Kane and Phyllis Scott, as tenants in that unit, had any way of knowing whether that latch would open freely even when it was supposed to be locked. They're the only ones who could know that, and they didn't communicate that.
In fact, they used a broom handle, didn't they, to help secure the door?
They did, Your Honor, which is prudent to do even if the latch works. very prudent to do, even if the latch works. And there was not a legal requirement that there be a so-called Charlie bar provided, which the theory behind a Charlie bar is that you can't open the sliding glass door in that manner. But there was no requirement that there be any kind of Charlie bar provided, and to the extent they thought they needed that, they had a broom handle. And they admitted that they weren't very good about putting their broom handle there. But the record is clear that there was no written notice by them to the apartment complex that there was a problem with the door. There is no evidence by the plaintiff.
But there is evidence that even in apartments where the door latches worked, that you could circumvent the door latch.
There was evidence that that has occurred, but that would be, I mean, everything wears out. And that would reflect no more than the inevitability that with time, depending on differential settlement in a location like Houston where you have gumbo soil, sometimes you could have something get out of alignment, and yes, it would be possible to work it out in that manner. But if the apartment complex isn't placed on notice by the tenant, during her tenancy that happens, they have no way of knowing it. And the whole purpose of that statute is to require the tenant to make the owner aware. This isn't a case where they never provided the lock to begin with.
The management had actual notice, whether they had written notice or not. They had actual notice.
That's disputed, Your Honor. That's disputed and was resolved by the jury in favor of the petition.
But if the issue is that the charge led the jury, we can't look at that because any factual issues are resolved in favor of
them. This is true, and that's why I did extensively address the evidence for the purpose of the court's harmless error analysis.
There is an indication in the respondent's papers below that the respondent has a terminal illness. Do you know anything about the status of that?
I was not trial counsel, but I believe she may have died. She was close. She was close at the time of trial. She was definitely on an irreversible downward slope.
Was that as a result of of this assault?
It was uncontradicted that she had the disease before the assault.
Does that make this case moot?
No. Her estate certainly has an interest. The same interest that she had, although she won't be around to see the result, which could be a good or a bad thing to anyone. You know, I don't know that affects this court's approach at all.
When generally we get a suggestion of death and then someone comes in representing the estate?
Procedurally, and that's why I'm reluctant to say that. My recollection is that she is deceased, but I wouldn't want to say that my opposing counsel didn't do what he was supposed to do. I actually am not certain of that. It was never significant to anything that I did in the case. And perhaps she's deceased. My co-counsel did try to counsel.
Any other questions? Thank you. Thank you, counsel. That completes the argument and the first call. We'll take a brief recess.
All right.